Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
It's the time for fall migration.
It is indeed. It is the best time of year. And it's always a toss up. You know, spring is great. The month of May is pretty spectacular with everything coming back and everything all colorful. But really, we get more overall birds, I think, in fall. They're not always as colorful or as easy to find, but everything is coming through. Some of our local birds are already gone and new ones are coming in, and this will continue through, I mean, really into, you know, November and December. Things will still be moving, but September and October are the big push for all of the songbirds that breed across, you know, the boreal forest, the kind of northern temperate parts of the continent, are moving south in some fashion, either, you know, a short distance to just the southeastern states or all the way to central South America. There are some songbirds that go pretty far down as far as Peru and even into Bolivia. And then, of course, the shorebird migration. I mean, that's probably our best feature out here, and it's why a lot of people come out here, birders come out here, not as much for songbird migration, but to see all of our shorebirds that are coming through. And fall is when we really shine. We don't get much of a spring shorebird migration because they tend to go up through the middle of the continent. But now they follow this kind of elliptical migration where they head to the coast. They head to the Canadian Maritimes and New England and then go south from here, often nonstop out over the ocean. and so this is the time to get out on the beaches. And the shorebird numbers will be going down from here on out, but there are some really interesting species out there that you could find, things like buff-breasted sandpiper and barred sandpiper and things like that. And whimbrels are still around if you go to like Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. And if you're lucky, maybe you'll see a Hudsonian godwit somewhere. If you can get out and chat them, that's not as easy as it used to be getting out to the classic birding hotspots in Chatham. Just the shifting sands of Chatham have made it a bit difficult to get to the old hotspots and get out to Monomoy, but it's okay. Some of the more easily accessible places can have all of the good stuff. So just find your local hotspot and enjoy those shorebirds while they're here.
And so hotspots that people could get to. If you can get out to Cuttyhunk, Cuttyhunk's a good spot, right?
Yeah. yes. Not for shorebirds necessarily, but overall, that's become like a little birder knowledge kind of birding spot. You know, you have to take a ferry to get out there. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty cool little island, and then you sort of have to know what you're doing. You have to walk, you know, walk around the island once you get there. The locals use golf carts, but it's positioned like thrust out into, you know, that's the outermost island in the Elizabeth's chain there, like out into Buzzards Bay. And it just tends to catch things. And there are some birders who go out there pretty regularly. A guy named Mike Sylvia goes out there a lot, boats out there. He takes his own boat. And he did really well. Things that you don't see around here so much, like white-eyed vireos. He had like 9 of them. Were to go birding out where I am, you wouldn't see any probably. And it just, you know, there've been some quite rare birds found there. It tends to catch migrants, and there always tend to be interesting things, good numbers of songbird migrants in particular.
Joe in West Harwich has already sent us an email, and he said, I took this photo of a black-backed gull attempting to swallow a deceased tern on Nauset Beach last Saturday. It reminded me of something I witnessed several years ago. I was at an outdoor pizza shop near Haymarket in Boston when a herring gull on the ground charged into a group of 10 to 12 pigeons that were squabbling over a pizza crust that someone had discarded. I thought that the gull just wanted the pizza crust, so I was shocked when the gull grabbed a pigeon, flew about 20 feet away with the pigeon in its beak. It landed in a more secluded area near a dumpster and proceeded to jab the beak into the pigeon. It gets a little gory here, so I'm not going to like ruin your breakfast with that, but I wonder how often gulls act like raptors and prey on other birds.
Quite often.
Oh, really?
Gull
wow.
versus, gull versus pigeon, who do you root for in that fight? Talk about talk about a couple of species that need a PR manager. but yes, gull, there are all kinds of stories. The big gulls in particular, the smaller gulls do their bad deeds in other ways, like laughing gulls or kleptoparasites. They steal fish from other gulls. The bigger gulls are brutes, particularly when you get up to the great blackback gull, which is like the size of an osprey practically. I've seen them do things like, you know, a bunch of gulls are just standing peacefully on some flats in the winter, and all of a sudden it reaches over and starts bludgeoning a ring-billed gull to death, and then eventually eats it. And, you know, they're famous. They'll eat a dovekie whole. A dovekie is a little mini nerf football sized seabird. They're trying to live out there, and they're big, and being a big brute is part of their strategy for staying alive, passing on their genes. And we can't judge. Who are we to judge, Mindy?
No, you got to survive, right? Joe has another. He says, in other nature news, I parked in the old Irish pub parking lot just north of Route 28 in Harwich to drink my iced tea this morning. And for the third time in the last 6 weeks, I saw a good-sized seal cruising in the middle of the Herring River heading toward the ocean. When I first saw it a few weeks ago, I thought it was a river otter. But when I saw the size of the animal, I realized it was a seal. I'm guessing it's a harbor seal, and given my multiple sightings, it appears that it lives in the river. Pretty cool to see a seal that far inland, and I'm guessing it's a sign of a healthy river ecosystem.
Yeah, yes, they will. They'll go pretty far up. There are like the headwaters sort of Pleasant Bay all the way up into Orleans. You'll see seals. they have no problem traveling up. If there's fish, they'll go up there, and you do see them occasionally.
If you have a nature question or a story you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what's going on with the American white pelicans?
Good question.
But we're seeing some, right?
A spate of sightings, yeah. I first became aware, our good friend Mike O'Connor at the Birdwatchers General Store is a good birder himself. And he, near his house in Orleans, he sent me this beautiful photo of the American white pelican flying overhead. That was last week. And I'm trying to figure out where it was first. But then there was one on Nantucket, either before or after that. It might be the same bird. It kind of looked like the same bird. Then there was a report of two on the vineyard. I haven't been able to follow up on that one, and I don't think it's been confirmed. If anybody on the island can confirm whether there were two American white pelicans there the other day, that would be great. Call in, email, or whatever. This is not an expected species. This is the pelican. So people probably know brown pelicans better. When you go to Florida in the winter on vacation, you see brown pelicans hanging around the fishermen and that kind of thing. And they breed there. The brown pelicans breed in the southern coastal U.S. But the American white pelican is a little different. It's a bird of the prairies. It breeds in these huge marshes in the interior of the continent, in the prairie regions. And then they winter in Florida and beyond. And when I did a hawk watch in Mexico, you could see big swirling flocks of American white pelicans heading into southern Mexico and Central America. You can see them in Florida too, but they're not like a dock bird, like the brown pelican. So people aren't as familiar with them. And they're certainly not an expected bird around here. So it's a bird that flew... It kind of took a different trajectory, took a wrong trajectory on its way to Florida or whatever, or Central America, and ended up here. But it's a spectacular, they're huge. I mean, it's a big, spectacular bird, and the ridiculous bill. I mean, hard to misidentify with a good look. So be on the lookout. I mean, could still be around. I'm not sure where it was last seen or what, but obviously be on the lookout for a big giant white bird with a bill the size of a Volkswagen.
Speaking of big birds, haven't we seen some sandhill cranes around as well?
Well, yeah, some folks I know in Wellfleet have reported them a couple times. I haven't seen other reports, but they reporting like up to five.
Wow.
But I hadn't seen other reports of those. And that's a bird you should always be on the lookout for. I mean, they've increased quite a bit. Talk about another big spectacular bird. But they've been breeding in Massachusetts now for the last 10 years or so. First in kind of central and western Mass, and now in the South Shore, there's a place where they breed as well. So, and they've just increased in the Northeast overall. And so more expected in migration in the winter sometimes, certain places. But yeah, I mean, that's something people should have in the back of their minds as a possibility. You know, somebody very new, like brand new, gets confused between cranes and herons, I find. You'll see people that they're talking about a great blue heron, but they call it a crane, you know, just, but they are different. They have the cranes always fly with their neck out straight. And then they have this very distinctive flapping style. That's very unlike the, you know, that kind of lumbering flight of a great blue heron with their neck tucked in an S shape and the big legs. The cranes are kind of more straight. The neck is straight, the legs are out straight. They're not as long as a great blue heron. And then they have this flight where the upstroke is faster than the downstroke, and it gives it this kind of like jerky. The wing beats have kind of a jerky motion. It's very distinctive at a long distance, in my experience. So if you're wondering, like, well, is that a real crane or is that a great blue heron? Yeah, those are the things to look for. And then they have that red forehead as adults.
Right. Hillary writes, how accurate do you think the Merlin Bird App sound ID is? I've gotten some rarities like a Wimbrel and a peregrine falcon. We are on the coastal embankment near Nauset, so it's possible.
Yeah, I haven't tested it myself, but you can't, like, Merlin is incredible, first of all. The stuff they've been doing, and I've been recommending it for years as your, you know, when I do bird ID workshops, I say, start with Merlin. It's free. It works as a field guide app. And at this point, they've been upgrading it so much and so rapidly. You can now use it. It functions as a free digital field guide to a lot of places in the world, from Western Europe to Colombia, all through Central America. You can use this as a digital field guide with photos and map range maps and even sounds for all the birds in those areas. I don't know how they're doing this and still maintaining it as a free app. It's the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's app. But now they've added what people have been asking for years and years. This is a question I've been getting for so long. When is there going to be something like Shazam, that app where you hold it up while a song is playing and it tells you what it is? And it's a very, very different computational process doing that for bird song versus a recorded song. But they figured it out. And there were a few different apps. There's one called Song Sleuth was, I think, the first one to come out. And BirdNet is another one that didn't come out that long ago. And I'm getting confused. I don't know if that's the one that has been incorporated into Merlin. But now Merlin is your one-stop shopping. You can use it as a digital field guide. You can give it a photo to ID. And I've seen that just in the last, you know, week and a half or so, I've seen that work to help somebody identify a rare shorebird and not work when they didn't scroll down far enough to see the other choices and went with the ridiculous rare choice. So, you know, all that to say, you need some kind of baseline knowledge. You need to kind of check other sources. It's not an infallible thing. You just point your phone at something and it knows what it is. You know, we're not at the kind of Star Trek level yet where it's analyzing the DNA of the bird, you know.
Yeah,
so
not yet.
So it gives you choices, right? And it gives you five or six multiple choice, and then you have to kind of take it from there. And it could be that it's none of them. You know, if it wasn't a good listen, or, you know, wasn't a good recording or whatever. But certainly peregrine falcons and Wimbrels are things that pass by Nauset Beach. I can't say whether that's what.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the good things about fall and spring migration is that you just don't know what you might see, right? And I know you said sometimes a little more colorful in the spring, but now's really a good time to kind of keep your eyes open, right? Because, you know, at your bird feeders or flying around your yard, because you don't know, right? It could be something interesting.
Yeah, if fall's an especially good time for feeder rarities, like it's through winter, like starting now, but all through and through the winter. And so, you know, leave your hummingbird feeder up is what we always say, because a hummingbird could be arriving to this area from the Pacific Northwest by accident in November. You know, have some pineapple sage out and you'll be the one to catch that bird. And it's not a thing where like, oh, by having the feeder up, you're tricking it and it needs to know it needs to know it has to go south. No, by having the feeder up, you're letting it live because it's not going to fly any further and it needs food to live. And that's a case where a feeder can help an individual bird. But yeah, I mean, the things that, a lot of the things that could be turning up here that are unusual might visit feeders. So it's a good time to scrutinize what's hopping around under your feeder or on your feeder or whatever. There's some interesting sparrows all through October. There'll be interesting sparrows, but even those have started already. Some lark sparrows turned up a few weeks ago. So we're just in the thick of it, and everybody needs to be vigilant. And what I always say in bird ID workshops, just get to know your common things cold, you know, the things that are at your feeder every day. And so then you know when there's something unusual, like when the dick thistle turns up among your house sparrows, which is a thing, it's a thing that happens. They look a lot like house sparrows, but it's got a little bit of yellow on the breast, a little wash of yellow, and the face looks a little different. And so if you really have studied your house sparrows, hopefully you don't have too many house sparrows. Yeah. But if you do, and if you know that, hey, this thing's a little different, and then you tell me about it. Or no, better, you just report it to eBird or one of
You'll
your,
see
you
it
know,
on
one of
eBird,
the,
yeah.
eBird, yeah, yeah, or one of the Facebook groups.
And so you mentioned hummingbirds, and Eleanor in Vineyard, I think it was she was on the Vineyard, sent us a video. I don't know if you got a chance to look at it. She's in West Tisbury, but she said she had two hummingbirds that caught her eye. They sat on a cord between two trumpet vine supports. I guess they were a little bit active, and she's just wondering about that. No, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, we can wait until after the next break to answer that. But hummingbirds are still going strong, right? So how much longer are they going to be around?
I've had them elucidation. I don't have a video. I say forward hummingbird behavior, but there's no video. They'll be around another week or two. And I've had stragglers show up at my house into the first week in October. And that might be a little bit later than they used to. I'm not sure. But typically mid-September is when they're heading out. And at Cape Cod Bird Club last night, a little plug for Cape Cod Bird Club, we have monthly meetings September through May. Check us out. And then there are programs. We have speakers once a month, except for December, September through May. And last night's was a great speaker named Mark Wainwright. He's a guy, expat, British guy living in Costa Rica and doing environmental education down there and around birds and other things and working for different organizations. But he's a hummingbird expert, and he gave us a talk about hummingbirds in Costa Rica that was excellent. And something I didn't know, two things. First, I asked him if they were there already. Our ruby-throated hummingbirds have already shown up. And that's about as far south as they go is Costa Rica. And they've already started showing up down there. So, you know, you get the early the early exiters, and then you'll get the lingerers that probably tend to be young birds. I would guess, and this is generally true, a lot of the hummingbirds we're still seeing are young ones, and a lot of the adults have already gone. And so the ones they're already seeing in Costa Rica are adults. But something I didn't know, I somehow missed, even though it was 3 years ago, but Costa Rica banned all forms of feeding wild animals, which includes hummingbird feeders. And if you've ever been down there or anywhere in Central and South America, you know that hummingbird feeders, especially in the higher elevations, is just like the classic thing. Every lodge, every tourist lodge has them because so many birders go down there. And they even do, you know, they'll put out bananas and stuff for toucans and tanagers and other birds. And it's a pretty spectacular thing to just sit there in the veranda with your coffee and, you know, watching these birds. Mm. I mean, talk about, they put our chickadees and sparrows, we're getting at our bird feeders to shame. It's, you know, monkeys are coming in. It's ridiculous. But they banned that, and it's certainly been controversial within the ecotourism and kind of birding community down there. But, you know, maybe because of the pandemic and nobody traveling, I somehow had missed this. I was supposed to lead a Costa Rica trip a couple of years ago, and I couldn't go because it was when my daughter was being born. But hopefully our the powers that be here don't ban all forms of animal feeding. I don't see that happening.
Well, and we've had that question about, the bird feeders coming down, and where are we at now with that?
Yeah, that's in the rear view window. I mean, that was sort of a blip. It took a long time because the state did the right thing and offered a hotline, offered a way for people to report suspected cases or anything. And so, you know, of course, they got a lot of reports and photos and things that were not really verifiable, that were probably like window kills and cat kills and things like that, which is overwhelmingly what kills birds around here is cats and windows and other, you know, other normal diseases that are happening in the background. But this was they never solved the mystery of what this illness was. It was something that popped up in states from Georgia to Kentucky and Indiana and got as close to us as Pennsylvania. There was some talk of confirmed cases in Connecticut, but there's no way. and then it went away. And the birds had specific symptoms. It was young, it was juvenile birds, and they had conjunctivitis-like symptoms in their eyes, and they seemed to have neurological symptoms. They ruled out every normal disease that we know of that kills birds. And it just left us with a mystery. And so one theory was that it very closely matched the outbreak of Brood-X cicadas. We don't have those. And even within a given affected state like Virginia, this disease, whatever this was, only happened in the parts of that state that had the Brood-X cicadas, because they're the cicadas were not uniformly distributed. They're only in certain counties of certain states. You can look at maps of that online. And so it's not clear what the mechanism would be there, you know, something that they were harboring in them, or, you know, that was affecting the juvenile birds, but not adults so much. And I mean, a real mystery. And some of these things, when you look at other case studies, things like the Wellfleet Bay virus that mm-hmm. affects common eiders here on Cape Cod, still a lot of mysteries about that, though they did eventually isolate the virus. They still don't know. I mean, like 15 years later, we still don't know how the eiders get it. And then there was a case of bald eagles dying off at a lake in Arkansas. And it took somebody literally their entire career to figure out the mechanism, like 25 years.
Wow.
And it had to do with an invasive aquatic plant that the coots were eating that was harboring a toxic cyanobacteria and then getting into the eagles. So, you know, the world, the natural world is sort of hopelessly complex with interacting variables. It's not like test tube science where you can control the variables. It takes a lot of work to figure these things out. So all that to say, I wouldn't expect an answer tomorrow, but certainly it's been okay to put your feeders back up. And we now know with hindsight, of course, is 2020. We know we never needed to take them down in Massachusetts, but it was sort of a recommendation out of an abundance of caution.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, okay, and probably a good idea to keep the hummingbird feeders up for a little bit, since you say they're around for a little bit longer.
Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier, because you could catch one of those vagrants. Like it's typically a rufous hummingbird. That is your standard rare hummingbird. And this is just a strange phenomenon here, particularly on Cape Cod, where we pretty much expect them to, you know, one or two or three to show up on the Cape sometime in late fall, fall anyway, into early winter, mm-hmm. where, you know, someone left their feeder up or they still had some plant, you know, something flowering outside and they see it. And, It's pretty common. And rufous hummingbirds are very hardy. They breed, if you look at their distribution, they breed along the coast up into Alaska. Mm-hmm. And they arrive to their breeding grounds pretty early in the spring. So imagine what coastal Alaskan forests are like in April and May, right? And not a lot of flowers.
Right.
And not
cold.
Warm. I've worked not in Alaska, but even in Washington, much further south, cold, rainy, nothing flowering. And this is the environment these birds are coming back into. And we tend to think of hummingbirds as these delicate little flowers.
Because they look that way. Yeah, but they're hardy.
Of course. They are certainly delicate.
Yeah.
But in terms of their ability to survive cold, they can do that. And they can find food. They're eating a lot of insects. They can do tree sap. You know, they have things figured out that we don't even know about. But certainly, it's not going to survive the winter here without supplemental food.
Right.
So it's somewhere where somebody left their feeder out, like I'm saying. But it's typically these rufous hummingbirds, and they should be wintering in like Western Mexico. But for whatever reason, you'll get individuals that end up here. They just follow the slightly wrong angle, leaving from, you know, southeastern Alaska and southwestern Alaska.
Oops. Here
and
we
then,
are.
And yep. then, yeah. 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 And right. here they are.
All right. Let's talk to Lisa, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. Yesterday, I was walking my dog over by Snow Library in Orleans, and I noticed under a tree, a hawk, I saw it, but it had a really small head, and its head was dark, but he had white legs and kind of a herringbone pattern on his tail. I'm wondering what it was. I looked it up last night, and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, I don't think anything has white legs, like pale yellow or...
No, I mean, they were white, thick and fluffy.
Oh, the feathers were white. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sure it was a red-tailed hawk. I'm sure it was a red-tailed hawk or a Cooper's hawk. The herringbone pattern, maybe a young red-tailed hawk. I mean, was it big and chunky looking? Like, would you be worried about your cat or small dog if this bird was in your yard?
Kind of. He was pretty big, but his head was small. And I see red-tailed hawks all the time in my where I park in Orleans, and this didn't look the same. His legs were, I don't know, it's weird. But
yeah, I mean, most hawks, they have fluffy white feathers covering the upper leg. Eagles,
okay.
one thing that separates hawks and eagles is how the extent of the feathering on the leg. So eagles have feathering all the way down to the toes. And not many hawk species have that. One or two hawks around the world will have that. But typically, hawks have a bare tarsus, that kind of that lower part of the leg.
Okay.
So you can see the skin. You know, you can see the skin of the leg. But there's all kinds of tricks depending on how they're sitting, whatever. The two most common hawks around here are Cooper's hawk and and red-tailed hawk. And those are the only two things I would expect to be in that situation. And especially if you were perceiving it as big, Cooper's hawk is like crow-sized, a big Cooper's hawk is crow-sized. And then a red tail is, you know, big, hefty, much bigger than a crow. And there are a lot of young red tails around right now. They end up in weird places and they don't have that rust colored classic red tail of an adult. And it does have kind of broken, like narrow bands on it. I don't know if you'd call it a herringbone pattern, but that description better matches red tail than it does a Cooper's hawk. Cooper's hawks have pretty wide bands on their tail and their tail's long. And they have and they have chicken legs. They have long chicken legs, Cooper's hawks do. So I'm you know, just it sounds like a red tail that was just hitting you funny or without a photo, I'm just, you know, I'm just saying words.
I know. I tried to take a picture of him on my phone, but I was too far away and I was walking a very small dog. So I was
All right, Lisa, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have a listener in Brewster who says, I saw a large group of large birds resting on the flats in Brewster yesterday. The day before, they were on the flats, but about a mile away. They were facing into the wind, opening their wings to dry them. Were they loons?
No, they were double-crested cormorants. That's the classic cormorant behavior. They don't seem to have the waterproofing that ducks have, where they can just do whatever they want in the water and then just take off and fly. They have to drip dry. So that's, I mean, you see this anywhere. There's a big rock right around now.
Yep.
There are two big rocks we can see from Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. When you, if you go out to our beach, and they're always covered in two things, cormorants and cormorant poop. And they're often, they're often holding their wings out like that to dry off.
Yep. And then Jane wonders if you could recommend us any boat trips for seeing migrating birds. Now, whale watches are good for seeing birds, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the number of things you can see goes up around now. You still have the four species of shearwaters that are in our waters right now. Birds coming from various parts of the globe to feed in our rich waters, just like the whales do. Great shearwaters, Cory shearwaters, Manx shearwater, and Sooty shearwaters, literally, you know, coming from other hemispheres in some case to be here. And then storm petrels, Wilson storm petrels in particular, but you might start seeing some phalaropes out there, some interesting migrating gulls. You know, birders are always hoping to see like a Sabin's gull. It's a beautiful little Arctic gull that is much more common on the West Coast in migration, but we do get some in places like Race Point, often a good place to see a Sabin's gull. Obviously, you're pretty much limited to birds that like to be on the ocean. Not entirely, because sometimes a wayward warbler on its way from the Canadian Maritimes southwards, caught out over the ocean and feeling a little tired, will end up on any kind of boat that's out there. But yeah, that's pretty much it, unless you want to charter a boat to get to one of the islands and, you know, get somewhere in Chatham. It's tough these days. You have to kind of find your own way to get to the good shorebirding spots that require a boat. But yeah, whale watch can be great.
And I would say if you go on the whale watch, let the naturalists know that you're interested in the birds. So because obviously they're going to be talking about the whales, but if they know there's folks interested in the birds, they may talk a little bit more about the birds as well. We have Melissa giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. My question is, in the fall, when my shrubs start losing leaves, I see leftover bird nests from the season. I usually have cardinals, robins, towhees nesting in my shrubs. Should I leave the bird nests alone, or should I clean them out? What's your suggestion?
Good question.
Yeah. You only really do any kind of cleaning if it's in a bird box. So this was just like a cardinal nest in a thicket, or probably even more likely a catbird nest in a shrub. They don't use them again. It's not, there's no maintenance required. Maybe they'll repurpose some parts or another bird will, but for the most part, songbirds don't reuse the nests they build. Raptors do. They've invested a lot of effort into building those gigantic nests, the ospreys and eagles and things. But songbirds, their nests tend to be pretty gross, and there are a lot of parasites in there, and it's close quarters. They don't use them the following year. Bird nests are still protected and under the blanket of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, but it's a little silly with something like a robin nest that they won't reuse. It's just, it's like leaves on the ground. It's just last year's thing that will not really have a purpose. But there's no reason to take it down. Just leave it alone. It is part of the environment, and mice will use them. Depending on the kind of nest we're talking about, like white-footed mice will use them. And sometimes you'll find an old nest with a bunch of cherry pits in it, wild black cherry pits in it. And that's sort of a classic thing that tells you that a white-footed mouse was using that. And so, yeah, there's nothing you need to do, but it's just part of the environment, and it'll eventually erode away.
Okay, Melissa, thanks for the call.
Okay.
So you mentioned osprey. I'm noticing a lot of the osprey nests are empty, but I think about a week ago I still saw an osprey on one of the nests. Are there still a couple hanging around?
Yeah, I feel like that very prominent one by Burger King on Route 6, that not every year, but some years, is on top of that big giant, high tension power line tower right next to Route 6. I feel like that one has had a bird still on it. Trying to think of the last time I was by there. And there's one I've been seeing locally where there's still a bird on it. So at this time of year, what's happening with ospreys is the females are probably all gone, the adult females that raise their young. And that's certainly true of a lot of locally nesting things, shorebirds. The females will go first. And then you've got some young ones that are still hanging around. The young ones just sort of do what they want. They'll do strange things. They'll fly north before they fly south. They'll hang out. They'll beg to nobody because they're lazy. They're kids. How kids are. And then occasionally there will be a long-suffering male will stay behind with a chick that's having trouble fledging or whatever. And so you might be seeing that. You might be seeing migrants who are coming through and stopping for a little bit. Young birds just kind of moving around. If you're consistently seeing it and it's a nest you have been following, then yeah, it's probably one of the local young ones that came from that nest that is reluctant to leave.
Yeah, just hasn't left yet. I'm not sure I want to fly that far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the video that Eleanor sent us that we can't open, she sent a still picture, and she says one hummingbird appears to me to be feeding the other one. And then up and left. So she's wondering if that is indeed what she's seeing. It looks like in the photo looks like the two beaks are touching, but I who knows?
Really?
Yeah.
I'll download this off of iCloud.
I just sent you the photo.
It's not something I've seen, but it wouldn't surprise me. I'm not sure. I really feel like young ones are on their own. I don't know why young hummingbirds would be feeding each other. I can't imagine there's much parental care still happening, but this is when they leave. So this would be very late for a hummingbird to still be dealing with recently fledged chicks. Oh, I've got the video.
You can see.
Oh, that's totally feeding a baby.
Oh, it's a baby. Okay.
Should have watched the video before I started talking. Everyone's shaking their head. Bird guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about again.
So it is feeding it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I've never seen that. It's still.
That's a great video then that she got.
It's a begging juvenile. But when was this taken? Did she say?
On September 4th. September 4th.
Grabbing for something. All right. Well, that was a long time ago. That was a long time ago, Mindy. I thought this was like. Yeah. Today.
No, September 4th. Yeah. Almost a couple weeks.
All
ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I still perceive that as quite late for a hummingbird to be feeding a fledgling like that. And that's a cool thing. That's not something you see very often. I mean, I certainly see hummingbirds in my yard, but I thought they nested pretty close. I thought they were nesting in my neighbor's yard a lot of years. But I certainly have not seen that kind of an adult feeding. It's an adult. It's always the female. Mm-hmm. The males don't help at all with raising the chicks or the nest at all. And September 4th feels very late for that. And it certainly, if it was yesterday, I would have been absolutely incredulous. Because, I mean, really, like I would
well, it's
expect
on the,
many
that was on the
adults.
Vineyard. Yeah, a couple weeks ago. Okay, good to know. All right, thanks, Eleanor, for getting that to us. Flying ants are hatching out right now. I don't like them.
You don't like them?
No, but the laughing gulls do, right?
The laughing gulls do, yes. I know. I had a couple, and they probably make people nervous. They made me nervous yesterday, and I really try to know my insect. And these ones on my house, they were like on the shingles of my house, and they were pale.
You're going.
They were like a beige color, like a termite.
There you go. Termites!
Like,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, no, no. But it's a little, I mean, the termites around, you know, Our termites are subterranean for the most part. But anyway, this is the time of year when the ant colonies are sending out what are called the winged alates, A-L-A-T-E-S. And this is the generation that grows wings and goes forth to start new colonies elsewhere. It's how ant colonies reproduce themselves. And they come out by the thousands. And this was happening in my yard yesterday. The collection of weeds and bare sandy spots that I call a lawn, I guess, in traditional suburban parlance. But there were lots of ant colonies in there, and they were just sending out these big winged forms. And so the flying ants get up pretty high into the air. We can't see them, but you'll see the smaller gulls, ring-billed gulls and laughing gulls that are more agile, fly catching on them. And it's very clear. It's something you go to a place like Coast Guard Beach or really any of the beaches, and you see this congregation of gulls acting like swallows, and that's what they're doing. I saw them doing it in Plymouth a little over a week ago, and I thought it might even have been some other, like a smaller aquatic, I said mayflies, but another aquatic insect that's even smaller than the flying ants, because I wasn't seeing flying ants. It seems like it wouldn't be worth it for a big bird like a gull. It's certainly not worth it for a herring gull or a great blackback gull. They're busy eating other gulls whole. they're not agile enough to be doing these kinds of acrobatics that it takes to catch these things on the wing. But I've been getting a lot of questions about that lately. Just, you know, people I know, like, I saw these gulls. They were all flying in this funny way at this beach. And it's fly catching.
It's them getting
ants.
those flying ants. All right. Let's talk to Borden, who's calling from Westport. Hi, Borden.
Hey, hi. Well, listening on the phone, he's just answered my question, because that is exactly what we noticed last night. Around 6 o'clock at night, 6:30, on the porch, looking in just that kind of setting, and they were doing exactly what you talk, kind of a medium-sized gull-like bird. It wasn't a tern, it wasn't a big gull, but they were acting like swallows, you know, chasing something up there and having a little feast. So that's what they were, and they. So thank you very much for telling me.
Well,
thanks for the call.
What kind of gull do you think they were? They were kind of a medium, and as you said, agile.
Yeah, they were ring-billed gulls or laughing gulls, some combination thereof. But just understand, I'm that good. I'm anticipating the listeners' questions before they even ask her. We've gotten to that point in this show.
But I did call a couple of minutes before.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Before
good.
You said, yeah. That's important. Thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
All right. So, Mark, some shrubs that we can add to the yard now to benefit winter birds. We're always looking like for those of us like me who are not putting up bird feeders because of the rats. Talk about what kinds of things we can put in the yard so that we'll get the birds and not the rats.
Right. As I say in my lectures about gardening for wildlife, trees and shrubs are the real bird feeders. But yeah, you can go see what your local nurseries have left for stock. They all carry some of these things. Like winterberry is a great one. Winterberry is our native holly, deciduous holly that's pretty common in wetlands, shrub swamps. But it makes a very good average garden soil, yard soil kind of landscaping plant. And birds love it. So if you have the space, get a few of them and then you're supposed to get a male. The hollies are dioecious, that you need a male and a female, unless you have some wild ones nearby, like I do on my street. And then you get this triple threat with trees and shrubs when you're landscaping for wildlife. So these things, they flower in the spring when all of our native bees are looking for food and establishing their colonies and growing their colonies. There's almost nothing more attractive to native bees, wasps, and other insects than the flowers of our native hollies. I mean, they're absolutely humming with activity when they're blooming in the spring. And then those flowers turn into these bright red berries that mine are just turning red now. It was a good year for them. Like, seemed to be a good year for every fruiting shrub in the world this year for mysterious reasons, even off Cape. And those red berries, they persist long enough into the winter that you get the winter interest, as the landscape professionals say, where the leaves fall off, but you get these gorgeous, like, cardinal red berries, creating a nice effect. But then, you know, they're there
then
for the birds.
The birds.
And
yeah,
so
the birds
I have this, I have mixed feelings when the bluebird flock comes in. It's mostly the robins that eat the bulk of them, but the bluebirds get their share too. I typically have bluebirds all winter, and I just have one. If I had a bigger yard, I would have like 15. And then red chokeberry is another good one. They tend to eat those a little later in the winter, so the fruits persist a little longer. And that is another one. The bees absolutely love chokeberry flowers when they're blooming in May. I'm trying to remember exactly, April and May. And those are available. Pretty much any nursery will have those. Oaks and cherries, if you're putting in any new trees, if you're having a landscaper put in trees, see if they can get some oaks. They are absolute powerhouses at feeding birds. They support hundreds and hundreds of species of butterfly and moth larvae. You know, everybody, there's a guy named Doug Tallamy, a professor of entomology, who's put out a lot of books about this in general, and one in particular just about oaks and how important they are as a keystone species for all of these insects. And then, of course, those insects feed the birds, and all of those little caterpillars that are on the oaks and the cherries and the willows, which are sort of the big three, that's what the birds are feeding their babies. So these are the most important.
Yeah, so it's all that circle. Yeah. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. As always, thank you, Mark.
Thanks. See you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.